Hello, my name is Mike Carver, and welcome to another episode of Stop Winging It, which is brought to you by Wingman Associates, a business and leadership coaching and consulting firm, and 10 Capital Wealth Advisors. Stop Winging It is a podcast for and about small business owners and entrepreneurs. We want this time to be dedicated to exchanging great stories and real-life experiences as we seek to support those who are starting or building their own businesses or wanting to improve their current situation. Our hope as a company and via this podcast is to help you make the next best decision professionally or personally. My guest today is Dr. Chad Krillich. He's a medical doctor who did his undergrad work at UW in Seattle and his graduate studies at the prestigious Tufts University in Boston, earning both an MD and an MBA. Starting mostly in family practice, Dr. Krillich quickly moved into leadership roles, including chief resident, assistant medical director, and medical director in the greater Tacoma, Washington area. He took his skills and experience in 2017, joined a well-known Providence Health organization, which has dozens of facilities on the West Coast, in the Santa Rosa, California area at Memorial Hospital as their chief medical officer, where he continues to today. He's been a contributor in multiple physician executive and leadership journals and an active change agent in the dynamic and challenging healthcare environment we all work hard to understand. A bit of a tech junkie, he also participates in multiple groups to advocate on behalf of improved leadership, processes, and overall patient care. We are fortunate to have him on the show, and I know you'll appreciate both his energy and passion for tackling the difficult and challenging issues we all face in our healthcare system. Well, thanks for joining us today, Dr. Krillich. It's a real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, this is a joy for me. For the listening audience, Dr. Krillich and I met up here in Dig Harbor, Washington, went to the same church and got to know each other, and we're in the same business. He on the provider side, me on the more on the vendor side, and then just kind of followed each other back and forth a little bit here throughout the years as he's moved down to Santa Rosa and continued his career. But I always think it's great in the beginning to go backwards a little bit and ask some of those really poignant questions of a 12-year-old, Dr. Krillich. What in the world? Somewhere between, 12 and 18, yeah. Science, biology, medicine, what surfaced? I mean, how'd that all happen? Is it in the family? Is it in the genes?
No, it's not in the family, actually. My father was a printing salesman, and my paternal grandfather was a park ranger. And so no medicine there. Yeah. But I would say, what pulled me in, one is as a youth, seeing both my grandparents pass. One was, my grandfather passed from cancer, and then a year to the day after he had passed, we witnessed my grandmother have a stroke in our living room.
Oh my gosh.
The ambulance come and take her to the hospital. She ultimately was discharged to a skilled nursing facility, but then, shortly thereafter she passed. So as a young man, I had said to myself, I'm going to make sure that doesn't ever happen.
Right.
It was a good vision. And I was very grateful along the way, had teachers and mentors who, for example, I vividly remember for any of your listeners who are familiar with the Washington area, Decatur High School in Federal Way, where I attended, my chemistry teacher, Jill Clark. I looked at her and I go, I don't need to know this chemistry stuff to go to medical school. And so she printed out all the requirements that went to go to medical school. And, she said, Chad, there's 2 years of chemistry if you want to get into medical school. So, I think along the way, that was part of my journey that got me into medicine.
Wow. Traumatic, to say the least, in the beginning to witness things like that. But yet, and I never asked, do you have siblings? Anybody else follow your path? Or did
Yeah, I have a brother. He is more in the software area. So, you know, as it relates to medicine, it is not in the family. So I definitely went down a different path, and it's been great.
Right. And then as you go through either the undergrad at UW or you know, moving out and, you know, to Tufts of all places, so you couldn't be farther away. Sure, your family was happy about that one. But what a great education. If Boston's not the medical center of the United States, I'm not sure what would be. But there's so much going on. Was family medicine? Were there ever thoughts about, I'd like to be a surgeon, or I really want to focus on this, or how'd that kind of come about a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, coming from a background where, you know, I had this sense of what I wanted to do. Some of your listeners might know of a colorectal surgeon. His name is Gordon Klatt. He started a practice in Tacoma and was very well known for his philanthropy and the work that he did as it relates to cancer prevention. And he happened to also be my dad's surgeon. And so I got to spend a day rounding with him in high school. And the advice that he had given me was to just get exposed as best you can to medicine to see if you really like it. And so over time, I volunteered at St. Francis Hospital in Federal Way, University of Washington Medical Center, Children's Hospital in Seattle. And as I was an undergrad, I actually worked at the University of Washington Medical Center as an orderly and then as a unit service coordinator, you know, essentially someone who answers the phones in the recovery room. And yeah. I think over time with each of those different experiences, I walked away feeling energized most days. So,
right.
All that led me, you know, through those requirements, including the 2 years of chemistry at the University of Washington.
Right.
And then one of the other things that you had referenced about, you know, surgery or family medicine, I did a research project with Peter Mansfield, a cardiac surgeon who used to work in Seattle. And so as I, you know, had completed that and was moving into medical school, my initial thought process as I entered medical school was to go down that path.
Mm-hmm.
And for those folks who might not be familiar with what that looks like, you know, your first 2 years of medical school, by and large, you're in a lecture hall and you're, you know, learning about the human body and you're learning about, you know, how to assess patients. And then in that third year, that's the year that you actually get back into the hospital. And as I was doing those clinical rotations, I really enjoyed each of the rotations, whether it was, you know, being on the medicine service or on the surgery service or doing OB or pediatrics. And as I was thinking through, and at the same time that the program I was at, I was also getting my MBA, which is another story.
Yeah.
I came to the realization that albeit, you know, surgery was really interesting and cardiothoracic surgery was really interesting, I was in a place where I felt as though I'd be more satisfied by being able to do a little bit of everything and incorporate some of what I was learning, you know, specifically around leadership and my MBA so that I would, you know, essentially run my own practice. So that was part of that transition and what led me back to the West Coast.
And that, you know, again, for the listeners, we mentioned the MBA. Was that always the plan?
Did
that kind of happen somewhere along the way?
Yeah.
I should add this in.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So at the University of Washington, I was going straight down, you know, the pathway that many students traditionally would for medical school. I was getting my bachelor's of science in cellular molecular biology. And then as I was taking electives, I took some economic electives and then became interested in that. And during that period of time was the initial time of the Clinton healthcare plan. So there was a lot of juxtaposition with economics and healthcare. And I continued to take economics classes. And then the debate was, you know, do I stay at the University of Washington for a fifth year and get a bachelor's of arts in economics, or do I apply to medical school? I would probably be not not being totally forward about that time. My bride, I was dating, and she was a year behind me. So it just so happens the dates lined up, and I stayed a fifth year. And when I was applying to medical school, I started to get what are called secondary applications when you make pass the first pass. And there were a handful of programs that had an MBA in it. And Tufts was one of them that you could complete in 4 years. It required you to take a bunch of classes before you got there and during the summertime. But it was a great program where we would take classes there. And for anybody who's familiar with Boston and Massachusetts, we partnered with two other schools. One was Northeastern and the other was Brandeis. So it was a really good experience. It's a fair bit of work, but I was grateful that to get that education to be where I'm at today. Yeah.
Well, and it positions you so well as people start to look at, you know, the role of a chief medical officer, which I'd love for you to describe as it pertains in your current role versus maybe your peers and people you've talked to. But just being as prepared as you were, what is, would you say, the role of a chief medical officer in an average institution in the United States today? Is it widely variant or?
Well, I think there's a couple things, right? If you've seen one chief medical officer job, you've seen one. They're all a little bit different in terms of their roles and responsibilities. All that being said, what I share with people about my job and why I come to work is to make my hospital the best place to work. I want people to come to work here more so than any other hospital in the country. And by and large, the role that I have is to ensure the quality and safety of the institution and then also get results. And you know, those results, you can tell whether you're getting them or not when you walk in the room just by the interactions with people that you have. And I share this where, you know, if you walk out of the room and you feel depressed, there's probably some work that you need to do in that room. The people who are there.
Yeah.
But if you walk out of the room and you feel energized, you're probably meeting those metrics. And if you aren't, you'll have a team that will get you there. And so the measurables are stuff that I'm sure, whether you're in medicine or not, you know, people are familiar with. It's how do your people feel about where they work? How do the people who come to where you work feel about what they receive there? And then do you get outcomes, whether they're financial outcomes or quality outcomes? And so that, I mean, as an overview of, you know, this particular role. And, you know, obviously in healthcare, we can make things, you know, pretty complicated, and I can dive into that a little bit more if you want to go any
further. Leading me right into it. So Yeah, for sure. I mean, and just in general, the last, you know, 20-ish years, spectacular changes in healthcare across the board. Not the least of which is all the different insurance plans and programs that that seem to confound and confuse, you know, the average person that needs something done. And but I would love to hear from the inside of a hospital when we went for, you know, sort of a pay as you play along the way to what we have now. What have you seen? What maybe the top one or two things that have been great? These are awesome changes that are happening. And here's the things that we're really still kind of working through.
Yeah. You know, I think in the years that I've been in practice, there are two things that bubble up for me when you ask that question. One is HIV. You know, when I was in training, when a patient received that diagnosis, the likelihood of them surviving was pretty small. And now it's a chronic disease that we manage with medications. And that happens because of really smart people doing amazing work, partnering with their patients to understand, you know, what is the right treatment regimen to help people return to doing what they want to do. So that's one thing that I think is a testament to what we do really well with medicine. I think, you know, the other one most recently for me, and, you know, being at Santa Rosa Memorial Hospital here, part of Providence, and a recent program that many other hospitals around the country have that's really quite remarkable is what we call a structural heart program. So historically, for anybody who may not know, when a patient has really severe heart disease, the surgery that we would have to do, essentially requires what to the untrained eye may look like a table saw going to a patient's chest. And then there afterwards, an open heart surgery is now a procedure that can be done through a catheter in the leg.
Yeah.
So
unbelievable. Right.
Right. In practice, if I, diagnosed a patient with a severe valve disorder and I would then send them, to get treatment for that condition, it would be weeks, months until I would see them back in the office. Now, those patients can be back that same week. It is a very short stay in the hospital. And it's remarkable when you see people who've had that procedure and they can't believe they had heart surgery and they feel so much better. So I think there are amazing things in the midst of all that's challenging in healthcare that we continue to do and continue to see, amazing outcome for our patients.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, and that's the best of, the industry I was a part of, teaming together with the industry that you're in and coming out with, whether it's drugs, therapy, regimens, devices, equipment, that has been a phenomenal partnership. I just think that we continue to both sides listen well to each other. If it could do this, and you get really smart people around a table and they figure out, I think we can make it do that kind of a thing. And I think I saw that a lot through the different companies that I was a part of and proud to be a part of them. Mm-hmm. But the same, underlying conditions just don't seem to get better, whether it's the metabolic stuff, whether it's heart, whether it's, diabetes. And so, I don't know, where are you on that? Sort of how do we help, get underneath the issues that are really troubling America and the world at large to keep them out of hospitals?
Yeah, I think for that is we look at the chronic diseases and, where do we need to go is a healthcare delivery system is how do we partner with our patients better? Mm-hmm. When I think of, a story that still to this day, I had a patient of mine who came in the office and part of my practice is when I'm sitting across from the patient as I would, look at the information in front of me and I would say, and this is not the patient's name, obviously. I don't want to make sure I don't get in trouble.
Sure.
Mrs. Jones, your BMI or body mass index is greater than 30. And so that means I'm going to put the O word in your chart. It's not because I don't like you, but it's because your diagnosis is consistent with obesity. And so then we would talk about that. And going through that conversation with patients takes time. There's not a lot of reimbursement for it, but we know that when we talk through what it is that can be done to help patients and just even having the conversation can decrease the likelihood of any population of patients having diabetes, heart disease, and the like. And the reason why I share that story is I remember the patient coming back to see me 12 to 24 months later. And I remember coming into the exam room and not even recognizing the patient. And so I would do what I normally do. I open up the chart, I show the numbers, and I look at this patient's weight. And I looked at her, I go, "What did you do?" And she looks back at me and she goes, "You put the O word in my chart." And so we had this great conversation where she talked about the steps that she took in order to, make right what was a troubling condition for her. Obviously we gave her some advice and things that that would help her along the way. But as I think about your question and the things that trouble people in our community and the conditions that they have, it is about as I see, the proliferation of technology and all the great tools that we have, it is critically important that we find a way to have direct dialogue face to face with our patients so that we can answer questions and really map out a plan for better health, which sometimes you know, may not include a pill or a treatment. It may include
exactly.
You know, changing how it is that you might be eating or exercising or reducing stress. So I think that's our biggest opportunity.
Yeah, I would so agree with that. I mean, it's great on the one hand that we've got life-saving medications, mm-hmm. But at what point do they become a crutch? And what point do they not really promote the better wellness, health of the actual patient? Mm-hmm. So now, as long as I'm taking this, I'll be okay. I can still do whatever I want to do. Might not be the best option, for long-term health. So I'm with you. And then, things that are working well, things that you talked about, just a couple off the top of your head, the heart and the HIV. Where do you see us working hard right now to meet current challenges? And maybe introduce maybe a little conversation here around COVID and its impact on your business.
Yeah. I think looking at the broader picture for healthcare and, what are the things, right, in my world on the hospital side of the fence that we see, routinely and, where is it that we want to be going? It continues to be the case that infectious diseases, certainly a term that we use in the hospital called sepsis, is something that right. We want to get better at treating. Heart disease as well, being a trauma center, and the impact that not only motor vehicle accidents, but certainly gun violence has, and being able to be ready to respond to the needs of folks in the community, I would say is paramount. There has been plenty that we've all read about COVID. I think, thankfully, as even we look at our own internal data, in the peak of the pandemic, it wasn't uncommon for some months out of the year where we would have a COVID positive patient expire every day. I make sure that I emphasize the word COVID positive because it doesn't always mean that the patient who passed actually was passing from that disease process.
Right. Sure.
That was in the peak of the pandemic. I think the good news now, as we're experiencing these different surges where, today we have about 20 patients in the hospital who are COVID positive, is that, those deaths, instead of happening every day, are occurring, every 2 to 3 weeks. Right. And so as a chief medical officer, obviously, anytime there's an inpatient mortality, that's something that we're very attuned to. But in reality, it's not the most common cause of death in the hospital nowadays. And so really, right. We look at the focus and impact of COVID today. What we're really seeing in trying to respond to, and I'm sure your listeners are as well, is the impact of how it is that we help our physicians and nurses come to work in the midst of being in this phase of the pandemic. Thankfully for vaccinations and things of that sort, we're not seeing a disease that has a high mortality. And so how do we keep our workforce engaged after, going through the throes of when the pandemic was really difficult? It continues to be challenging by virtue of us still trying to understand how do we, especially on the hospital side, given there's still many regulations in place, how do we climb out of this environment where,
right.
And understandably so, everybody was operating out of an abundance of caution where we need to make sure we're being reasonable and rational and putting those things in front of us that are really important, like I had referenced previously, whether it be, sepsis or heart disease or trauma. That's where our push is with our teams here.
Got it. Yeah, I mean, I feel like having been a part of it my whole career, I watched the differences when I started. We'll go back a few decades, and I could park my car in the back parking lot and walk in and walk right into the pharmacy and meet with my pharmacy director, or go right on the floor uh-huh. with an ICU nurse. And those things, as nice as they were, they needed to change. They just can't have all the No. Everybody walking around the hospital all the time. You know, whether it's gone too far or not, doesn't, you know, is not my place to say. But what it does do is it reminds people this is a special space, and having some control over who's coming in, who's going out, safety, all the things that happen as a result of our society in different ways. Mm-hmm. The hospital needs to not be a place where you go in and something happens to you or you get sick at the hospital, which mm-hmm. we know still happens, unfortunately. And mm-hmm. so those things are on the back of your brain all the time.
Yeah.
You know, as a CMO.
Yeah. No, without a doubt. I mean, I think there's two components to your comments I think about. One is, you know, how do we ensure the safety of the hospital from an external threat, if you will, for lack of a better
right.
term. And then internal, right? Because we know harm happens in every hospital across the country. And so I'll start with the internal. And I think, you know, one of the things that is great about being a part of an organization like Providence is that we're on a journey of becoming what's called a high reliable organization, or an HRO. And you know, the foundation of that is, you know, being really open and transparent about when safety concerns bubble up. And so one of the practices that we have and had this morning mm-hmm. every day is we have a safety huddle where we get all the leaders on the phone and we ask each of them to share looking back and looking forward. Are there any safety concerns?
Got
and
it.
In that way, we're all aware of the potential risks that we might have faced or are going to face today so that we can get out ahead of that. And so, you know, I think health systems that are taking that kind of approach for people in the community can be assured that we're keeping our eye on the ball to create a safe environment, knowing that there are risks in the hospital.
Right.
To your point on the external side, yes. I think about the requirements that it took for me to be a volunteer at St. Francis Hospital in Federal Way. And to try to do that now here, it's a whole different set of requirements, some of which ensures the safety for the person who's coming into the institution. And then at the same time, you know, I think everybody who's listening is well aware of some of the risks and things that have occurred in hospitals around the country where we want to ensure the safety for the people who are working in the hospital and our patients. Right. So there are practices and policies in place, including the use of security to ensure that's happening, as well as, you know, making sure that patients who are visiting, you know, as we're still in the middle of this pandemic, making sure that they have masks where appropriate and things of that sort. So it is definitely a different time. I think the good news is that knowing that, you know, especially as you look back at the history of medicine, we're moving into a space of being more transparent about the risks that are out there to decrease the likelihood of, you know, those sorts of harm events occurring.
Right. Yeah. Shouldn't be a total surprise to the organization. Right. I'm with you. So we're going to pay a quick homage here to our sponsor, who is 10 Capital Wealth Advisors. You know, if you're like most folks, the recent headlines and volatility that are being created are probably really concerning at the least, and possibly retirement changing at the worst. If you find yourself watching the market and your portfolio bouncing up and down a little bit more than you're comfortable with, and you don't really have any clear communication or defined path to success, maybe the timing's right to refresh the conversation with who's handling your money. You know, we did this about 10 years ago, and we developed a relationship with Tim and the group at 10 Capital. And having an advisor to help you make great financial decisions, to ask all the pertinent questions up front, even as simple as what does retirement mean to you and your spouse or your partner, can open up just a world of dialogue that wasn't there before. So we really highly recommend it. Getting this qualified second opinion, having an objective sounding board out there, that's just prudent planning. And when it comes to achieving your financial goals, prudent planning is what you need, especially if you're watching the headlines right now. People who are freaking out probably didn't plan prudently, probably didn't think in advance of these things. And so, you know, we feel great about what's going on. We don't love it, but we know that we've got a great plan in place. And Ten Capital is the right place for it, with nearly $1 billion in assets under management. Their growth is just due to the process they've got. They talk about your purpose and your plan and your portfolio, and they stick with it, and they stick with you all the way through. They are my wingman as it comes to financial advising. They take everything into account, from my constantly changing goals, which seems to happen all the time the older you get, to the changing marketplaces that we're in. I highly recommend them, and to learn more, please check them out at tencapital.com. So, you know, those were healthcare topics, and I'd like to switch just here a little bit because of your interest in leadership and your interest in just leaders that are coming through organizations now being what we need out there. So I see it in my business. We work a lot with small business owners, and what we try to do is come alongside, Wingman does, and help them make the next best decision. A small business owner, by definition, being somebody that's wearing 27 hats and everything is on their plate. I imagine that's a CMO on any given day with all the things that you see. And so just your interest in leadership, sure. what you're seeing as you're developing leaders moving forward. You know, I think there's a great conversation to be had around that right now. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so critically important. So as a chief medical officer, right, I cannot do this job by myself.
Mm.
And in hospitals around the country, you know, the structure is such that, you know, I have my executive management team, my chief nursing officer who I work with, chief executive, my chief financial officer. And then there are the people who I support in many chief medical officers do that are often referred to as medical directors. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, as I have been doing this work, the thing that I think is really important in, you know, not just supporting medical directors, but other leaders is for people to have like a really clear understanding as to why it is that they're doing what they're doing. Yeah. And what is it that they're doing to ensure that they can be able to do that each day.
Mm.
And yeah. It, you know, what I see happen for people who are not only appear happy, but are getting great results, is they've got clarity about that. And they do a really good job of taking care of themselves, generally speaking. And when I see people exit, I generally see that there either isn't that clarity, or there's a lack of imbalance in terms of how people not only care for themselves or for those around them, either inside or outside of work. And then that leads to disruption in the workplace and the need for them to step back. So that broad brushstrokes, that's how I see, you know, our challenge for people who are supporting leaders is to make sure that people are super clear, you know, why is it that you're choosing to do this work and what is it that you're going to do so that you're able to do it each day? Because leadership is hard. It requires a different skill set. I think for those who feel called to do it, it's a privilege, but it does require a different skill set, and people, I think, need to be super clear about what it is they're doing and, you know, how do they maintain that level of energy to do the work?
Yeah, that's just a great comment. You know, it occurs to me, people get into medicine and then their careers take off. I think I have, you know, something, and yours is a great example. It's not just do no harm and wanting to help others, but it somewhere in there, then you go, I can have a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm.
But I may not have the background or training, you know, because here we are dealing with infallible people and, you know, people who are by our very nature are going to have issues and challenges all the time with each other. So do you locally, or does Providence in general kind of support that continuing leadership education? Are there things that you have in place?
Yeah, both, actually. Providence does a great job of providing a lot of different resources, not only virtually in terms of getting people exposed to different aspects of leadership. But even in the middle of COVID, one of the things I'm very proud of the place where I work is, you know, for those who are listening, especially in the Washington area, right? Everett was the first hospital to have a COVID patient. And, you know, one of the things that Providence did is it got every leader in all 50 hospitals that it operates on the phone every day to share information and to share approaches as to how do we support people in healthcare that were scared. We do. And there was just some really amazing work, not only in sharing treatment protocols, but, you know, garnering PPE and all the things that went with that early on in the pandemic. And so I think that organizations that quickly identify, you know, that there is a gap and then bring people together, because through dialogue, I mean, I think any people, any group and any organization can work through those solutions, because right, to be in that space, generally speaking, when you get two or three folks together, you can come up with a good solution. And so I think that's one aspect of it. And then locally, we do find ways with which to give our leaders coaching. I think for anybody who's read Atul Gawande, he's a physician who's a well-known author. And he talks about, and he's right, as you referenced, in the center of the world for medicine in Boston. For those of you who are listening, I-90 doesn't begin in Seattle. It begins in Boston. At least that's what I learned when I moved there. I did argue that point a little bit to my Northeastern friends. But Dr. Gawande, you know, has a book and a talk about the need for a coach, even for a physician who's Harvard trained and at the Brigham. Everybody needs a coach. And so I think it's critically important, you know, whether you're in medicine, and certainly, you know, you look at sports, there's people who have all sorts of coaches, but any aspect of business or just personal growth, getting the opportunity to receive that feedback and for people to help you see your blind spots, it only, I think, helps us to get better, you know, no matter it is, what it is that you're working on. So I think both aspects, you know, local resource in terms of coaching and then broader brushstrokes in terms of how the organization pulls people together is what I see in terms of how leadership's advanced.
That's really smart. And it's a great comment. I mean, Tom Brady has a throwing coach, not because the coach is a better thrower than Tom Brady, Tiger Woods. It's not because that guy can swing a club better than Tiger. They see things, you know, they're attuned. They bring a different perspective, an objective point of view, a transparency that the great leaders want. You can become very good, but kind of that good to great book from years ago. To become great, you better have some objectivity and accountability in your life. And so where's that been for you? How have you maybe held yourself accountable over the years? People, mentors, coaches, how's that worked in your own life?
Yeah, I mean, as it relates to accountability, you know, for me, as I look at that, there are really four aspects that I've learned over time as I've gone down this leadership journey that are important to me. It's, you know, my faith, family, fitness, and, you know, I'll say fiduciary responsibilities. Like, of course, I had to stick with four F's. so from a faith perspective, I have a group who I connect with daily. Actually, we had connected in person on Fridays, but now we're all over the country. And we do it through an app, and we check in, you know, what are your hooks and hangups? And, you know, we ask the questions that you really don't want to be asked. And that for me has been instrumental in my growth and my faith and, you know, just really trying to be a better man. I think the other thing is, you know, sharing that with my family and them being open about sharing with me what it is that they're working on, you know, and specifically I'm talking about my bride and my kids. And then the other thing that I do is I'm a journaler, not just for faith, but just in terms of what I try to do and taking care of myself. I'm a runner. And as you stack on the birthdays, you try to understand, okay, how can I still do this? And so that's the aspect. Yeah. My goal for my runs now aren't times, but did I get injured or not? So minimize that.
A successful run. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then, I think, you know, as it relates to work, for me, it's helpful to articulate, you know, what is it that I want to accomplish at the beginning of the year? What are the steps that it's going to take to get there? And then I would say really over the course of the last, I would say 6 to 10 years, I'll have a 6 month in kind of check in and I'll write up something for myself to review. And I do share it with certain members of my team. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the first time I shared it, you know, there was this kind of look like, are you trying to tell me all the things that you're doing, and out of fear or anxiety? It's like, well, no, this is what I think I'm doing as an agent of the organization and what I think I'm trying to accomplish. And I want you to tell me, do you agree with it? And if not, tell me why. And if there's something that's not on here that should be on here, tell me, because the only way I know, any way I know how to get better is to document what I did and go back and look at it. So I think those are the components for me around accountability where I try to move to get better in those different areas.
Wow, that's outstanding. And thanks for sharing that. I know we had a good friend an old workmate who's moved through healthcare in a really kind of subtle and sublime way, Jim Wetrich. Mm-hmm. Actually was interim supply chain manager for Providence for a while through his company. And we call him Big Red. He wrote a book about leadership here recently, where good leaders go wrong. And part of it, he called out, was this sort of that new generations are not going to accept. And that is 360 feedback or feedback in general, just not happening often enough. Mm-hmm. The annual performance review, mm-hmm. to check the box to say, good, way to go, and give you a little bit of feedback and then, you know, hope that, you know, you make some course corrections. It's just not enough. And the average Gen, pick your letter, X, Y, or Z, is not going to wait a year to be told how I'm doing. That's just not going to happen. I think most organizations get it now. They see that. And we certainly come across that in our work with clients as well. Do people know their role? Do they know they understand their why, their purpose? And are you giving them feedback along the way? And I mean constant feedback along the way. And it sounds like not only are you taking care of that personally, but I'm sure that you're instilling that in your organization. That you want to hear it, right?
Yeah. I know a colleague of mine on the physician leadership realm says nobody likes to hear you're fine, you're fired.
but that's true. Yeah,
it is true. And so what he taught me and what I try to do with members of my team is to have them know, I need your feedback. I'm going to give you feedback. I'm not going to wait for the next, 30-day check-in or one-on-one. If I hear something that just doesn't seem right, it doesn't mean I'm going to come to you with like everything that I hear. But if it's verified and it doesn't sound right, or if it just sounds egregious, my commitment to you is to give you that information. Yes. And I ask that of the people who support me, the different chief executives and senior leaders that I've worked with. And I think creating a space where that is the expectation and that information is shared freely and being like super clear, this is not evaluation. And I often also, this is not an evaluation, this is feedback. And making sure people are open to it at the time, because obviously sometimes the way like, oh, you're giving me feedback, I'm not ready for that, or, feedback. But over time you learn that actually, at least I have, and I've heard this from people like, well, thank you, that's constructive. Those are the things, whether it's as a leader in an organization, as a spouse, or a parent.
Exactly.
Like those are, that's the type of exchange you want to have, because then you'll understand, you know, what your blind spots are, and what might you do differently about it. So it, I think it's critical in any industry that you create that. And specifically in healthcare, there are numerous stories where an environment unfortunately has been created where people are not comfortable giving feedback because they're concerned about either that anger and or retribution that may occur from that dialogue. And so they withhold information. And when that information is withheld, it can lead to patient harm. And so again, going back to Providence's journey around HRO and some of that work, you know, I think there's a lot to be learned. And certainly the airline industry has done a really good job of this as well, just being really open and transparent about sharing that information.
Yeah, that's so well said. I know that sometimes I joke with my wife, I long for the questions of a 7-year-old because my kids, you know, ranging from 36 down to 28, the questions are different and they're harder and they're more complex. And so I've learned the hard way, as you probably have with your own crew, as happy and as excited as we get about them and the same thing with an employee. Mm-hmm. Wanting the best for people, I still got to ask. So do you want some feedback, or were you just telling me something to tell me?
Right.
And I had to learn that in my own career, leading, you know, a wide variety of salespeople over the years. If it's egregious, I'm going to give you some feedback, but beyond that, are you saying that to me because you're wanting me to hear it, or are you wanting me to make a comment and feedback on that? And trying to discern that is not easy, mm-hmm. as a leader. And for a world that's very technologically advanced, you know, maybe they're used to getting that back in quick text form, you know, or video form or something. And how do we continue to stay in front of people and mentor them and coach them?
I think to your point, Mike, I mean, one of the things I'm learning is, you know, I'm Gen X, so I'm square in the middle.
Yeah.
That's helpful because I see this, you know, even in my workplace, like this last week, is clarifying for people, how is it that they want to receive information? Because
there you go.
People, I want a face-to-face conversation. Other people, it's a phone call. I have people that, right, they want to know via text. And just meeting people where they are in terms of how they want to receive that information. And if I know it's a face-to-face conversation, you know, I'll send a text to say, you know, here is what I'm putting out there, but I really would like to have a face-to-face conversation with you at some point, because there are certain things that just require that. I think as leaders, that's what I'm learning in my role, mm-hmm. and you know, squarely in the middle is understanding, to your point, like, where is it that we need to be in giving folks the information so that they can be successful?
Right. Right. And clearly I'm not using my own company name for false advertising, but you're a wingman at heart. I said that to my father when I made up the name, because the name is partly about him. He was an Air Force guy and he flew in Vietnam, and he's a wingman on many levels. But you grab me as somebody who you're not aspiring to be a wingman. You are. You come alongside people, you look for ways to help and support them, to help them be their best, mm-hmm. knowing that I can only do so much on my end. Mm-hmm. You know, that whole, I can lead a horse to water kind of thing. And I want just to congratulate you on what I've seen over the years, knowing you, seeing you, watching your career move. But I think in large part it's because you invite feedback. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't. There are a lot of really, really smart people in the world, and I love it when I see them asking for support, mm-hmm. asking for help, asking for, does that make sense? And are we on the right track? Those kinds of clarifying mm-hmm. questions, which I think are so crucial.
Yeah,
just so crucial. Yeah, yeah, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say I mean, I agree. You look at, think about the space shuttle Challenger,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a lot of really smart people in that room. as I understand the history of it.
Yeah.
And you look at some of those sort of events or events that happen in a hospital or in a boardroom or what have you, and it requires courage for people to ask the question. That, right, each of us has ownership in doing, and each of us has ownership in hearing the question, responding and asking clarifying questions, because that's how we'll get to whatever the best result might be.
Right. Yeah, that's well said. That's well said. You know, as we get close to wrap up, I'm going to ask a few maybe personal questions. Mm-hmm. But is there anything else that you would say to our listeners? Sort of a take heart, healthcare is not completely broken kind of message. Is there any parting sort of, you know, wisdom, that you might pass along or exaltation?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I think about healthcare and I think about the organization I'm a part of with Providence and the work that we do, I believe in the midst of what is really a tough time, we do in partnership with our patients and our communities, just some amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
We don't often, get to share all those stories, whether for example, here in Sonoma County, having a mobile health van that meets the needs of our homeless patients, or it's, that procedure that I referenced in terms of patients having a valve replaced through a catheter.
Right.
So I think that for people who aren't in healthcare, who may not be sure, especially as I think about the work that Wingman does and how those things align, is that the best thing that people can do is just ask questions. Ask questions, because our role in healthcare is to inform people, here are the risks, benefits, alternatives, and complications to whatever it might be that we're trying to navigate with you. And through that, you'll get the information that you need in order to make the right decision. And if for some reason you're not getting that information, either you need to ask the question again or ask it of someone else. And that's okay. I had often shared with patients that sometimes going to see a physician is like trying on a pair of shoes, and sometimes they fit, sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
So it is really about the relationship you have, with your physician and or nurse practitioner, or physician assistant, whatever it might be. Because when that relationship is solid, then everything else flows. So I am a big encourager of patients asking questions, because we are doing really good things in healthcare, but it takes a partnership.
Ah, that's great. And again, very well said. I feel like people forget sometimes that we're dealing with people. You can put a physician on a pedestal. You can put all kinds of people on pedestals and get this sort of false, imposter syndrome going, when what they really want, it's a relationship. Yeah. I just want to talk. I just want to ask questions. I don't understand it. I don't begin to understand high deductible, low deductible. I mean, we can get caught up, just wrapped around the axle so quickly.
Yeah.
And anybody that can break it down and make it simple and just look me in the eye and say, but here's what we want to do with you.
Yeah.
Here's where we are, you and I. And I think, boy, if we can get back to some of that. I had a guy on a few weeks ago, a local physician. We can get back to good old country medicine, as he said, and just like, how can we help each other? How can I help you be the best you? I think that's, I think that's where we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has been great. It's been a whirlwind tour here in almost an hour and covered a lot of ground. I'd love to ask a couple of questions. When the Krilliches get time, and I know you are in the heat of kids doing a million things,
because
I see it. Where do you guys go? What do you guys like to do as like vacations and things like that as a family? Where do you get away?
Yeah, we like to get to the outdoors.
Do you? Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think over the years, as I look at the times, especially as my kids are getting ready to launch and go to college, where we, you know, look back and talk about them. Anything that we have done where we've gotten our kids to any of the national parks around the country, time well spent. I mean, you know, from the days we're in Washington, whether it's Olympic National Park, Mount Rainier, you know, being down in California now, Yosemite,
right.
You know, having the chance to go to Grand Canyon, you know, those places, they change your conversation because it pulls you away from the phone. It pulls you away from the distractions. It's even better when your cell phone isn't working, which happens sometimes in those spots.
Thank God.
Right.
Possibly so, God induced, we hope.
Right. So, yeah, I think, you know, as I look back, those are the spots where those are some really good, really good times spent with family.
Yeah, that registers with me as an Air Force brat. And my dad tells the story, and I told this, I think, on one other podcast. My dad tells the story. We're in eighth grade. I've now moved six or seven times, and I'm in eighth grade. And he said, well, we got a choice in our next posting, which is rare. And he said, we're either going to Wilmington, North Carolina, or to Brussels, Belgium. And evidently I, as a really intelligent eighth grader, said, so what state is Brussels in? He said, thank you, Mike, for making my decision so very clear at this point. And I'm the benefactor of being able to live overseas for my entire high school life and the places we got to go and things and see what we do. And I went kicking and screaming, you know, and now all I do is tell stories about it. Mm-hmm. All I do is to say how lucky was I and not knowing anything at a whopping 13, 14 years old. So I love that. You know, the last question, which I like to ask of everybody, if you had the opportunity, living or dead, who would be the top people, your Mount Rushmore, so to speak, of dinner guests?
Yeah. I would actually say, and it probably, related to the phase of life that I'm in right now, knowing that in a couple of years my kids are going to be out of the house, and probably be my wife, my son, and my daughter.
Yeah, that's a good answer. For anybody listening right there, you see what he did? Put his wife in there first. Very smart man. Yeah. I will tell you how much I love that response, and I love it for a lot of reasons, but I love it because I'm at a stage a little bit further than you. Mm-hmm. And when all my kids left, and as happy as we were, you know, for a week or two, my wife and I, I found it to be far too quiet, far too quiet around the house. My wife asked me, why do I have music on all the time? I think it's because I miss my kids. truth be told. And I don't mind saying it out loud, and I hope my kids hear that. I love the family idea of just let's have a family meal. Let's share that. Yeah. There'll be farther and fewer between in the future. And they're sweeter when you get them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there will be. Now we have to think of, if I remember correctly, you know, what's the magnet that pulls them back? So that's our next.
There you go. That's right. Favorite food, best meal, best this, absolutely. That. What was it? How can I get you guys together again? Right. Oh, that's awesome. Chad, this has been a wonderful time. I really appreciate just the background, your insights on healthcare and leadership and everything about it. It's been wonderful. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, I know. Thanks for having me, and appreciate the time. And you know, hopefully people who are listening, you know, might find some wisdom in that and hopefully help them along their way, wherever it might be that that they're heading. So thank you for
that's our goal as well. I'm sure somebody will pick up some nuggets out of this and it will help them on their own journey. So you take care of yourself and that family. Enjoy your time in Santa Rosa. I hope our paths cross again soon.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. Thank you so much. You take care.